This report comes from numerous sources, including my own memories of this particular event. You know, in my life, I have been, well, you might say, enchanted somewhat by the strange and the enigmatic. All that began around 1962 with a UFO encounter in my parents' backyard early one morning in Bridgeport, Michigan. It was actually in my dad's garden. The UFO event I am going to share with you today is one which still haunts me, in that I will always wonder who or what was at the controls. It was October 30th, 1975, All Hallows Eve, and I was in the 11th grade. As I recall, that night was really quite chilly. My dad had a radio he let me use that picked up the standard AM/FM bands, but also shortwave. As I laid there in bed, alone in my upstairs bedroom, I tuned in a radio station of the famous War of the Worlds 1938 broadcast by Orson Welles, and the one that panicked the nation that very night, except 37 years prior. For some reason, I had a difficult time sleeping that night, and what always made that worse was that damned cuckoo clock downstairs that let me know every 15 minutes that I was still awake. Anyway, I began fiddling around with the radio dial and different bands. I don't recall exactly what time it was, but I'm thinking after 11 o'clock news, as Dad and Mom had already gone to bed. I had the dial almost as far left as it would go, though I don't recall the band. I began hearing chatter between the Wordsmith Air Force Base and a pilot out over Lake Huron. Wordsmith was just across Bennett Lake from my parents' home, maybe about a mile at the most from the main gate as the crow flies over the lake. The pilot was conversing about an unknown. They were following an unknown out over Lake Huron, and I don't remember any of the conversation except that, but I listened till they got down by Saginaw Bay when the unidentified object vanished. I'll get into more detail in a moment, but just a little more background. Wordsmith was the home for the 379th Bombardment Wing, which controlled the 524th Bombardment Squadron and the 920th Aerial Refueling Squadron. Wordsmith was one of the northern tier bases that housed nuclear weapons. I'll be going back and forth a bit using several reports. This first is from an amazing book titled Clear Intent by Lawrence Fawcett and Barry Greenwood. According to the book, about 10:10 p.m., personnel in the vicinity of the family housing area located in the southern portion of the airbase reported what appeared to be running lights of a low aircraft which was thought to be a helicopter. The craft hovered up and down in an erratic manner. Airman Martin E. Tackaby was assigned to the K-Park housing area gate, and he said that he saw the object for about 5 seconds near the perimeter of Wordsmith, due south of his location. Attackaberry reported that the object had one white light pointing directly downward and two red lights near the rear. Near the base main gate, Airman Michael J. Myers, who was assigned to the Police Unit 7, was on duty at the base motor pool. And Myers looked west and he could see several lights near the western edge of the base. The lights turned north and appeared to lose altitude, and he also heard no sound. Security police at the weapons storage area notified Colonel John J. Doran, Vice Commander, 379th Bomb Wing, that the guard located at the back gate had reported what he thought to be a helicopter overhead, and the command post notified Colonel Broadman, who was Wing Commander, and Colonel Doran, and they proceeded to the flight line. It was at this time that radar approach tracked the craft for about 35 miles on a southeastern bearing from Wordsmith. At the same time, a KC-135 tanker was returning from a refueling mission. It entered Wordsmith's traffic pattern and obtained permission to fly transition approaches, and Colonel Broadman ordered the KC-135 to attempt to identify the object. Aboard the KC-135 were Major Frederick Pappas, the plane's commander, Captain K.E. May, co-pilot, Captain Rick Meyer, the navigator, Captain Myron Taylor, instructor navigator, Captain Randy Higginbotham, instructor pilot, and Sergeant Steve Smith. Now I want to quote from the statement about that KC-135 encounter with the UFO, and it was given to the 379th Bomb Wing Historian Staff Sergeant Paul J. Cahill by Captain Taylor in a memo for the record dated January 18, 1979, considerably after the event. But it was reported, and I quote, "We were returning from a refueling mission, and during our first approach into the traffic pattern, RAPCON vectored us to check out a reported UFO in the area of Woodsmith Weapons Storage Area. And as I recall, this activity occurred between 10:30 and 11 o'clock in the evening around the 1st of November. I remember seeing lights similar to strobe lights, which were flashing irregularly. We followed the lights north, out over Lake Huron. At first, it was difficult to determine whether there were two different objects because of the irregular flashing of the lights. But after observing the lights, we determined that there were, in fact, two objects, and the irregular flashing appeared to be some sort of signal being passed from one to the other in an effort to maintain the same position. We were able to paint an object on the radar scope for about 10 seconds. I would estimate that our altitude was about 2,000 feet and our speed approximately 200 knots. Shortly after turning south in pursuit of the UFO, we called approach control and received blanket clearance to follow the UFO at all altitudes and at all vectors. Occasionally, RAPCON would pick up the UFO and help by giving us vectors to the UFO's position. I would guess that we stayed close to the UFO most of the time, approximately 1 mile away, and each time we attempted to close on the object, it would speed away from us. We followed the UFO down to Saginaw Bay and started across the bay when we lost it because of all the fishing boat lights. At first, we thought it had landed on one of the large oil tankers, but later decided that we had been wrong. We continued to search the bay area, but we didn't see it, so we changed our heading for Woodsmith. On the way back, we picked the UFO up again at our 8 o'clock position. We turned away and it proceeded to follow us. Finally, we turned back in the direction of the UFO, and it really took off back in the direction of the Bay Area. I know this might sound crazy, but I would estimate that the UFO sped away from us, doing approximately 1,000 knots. We continued in the direction of the bay until RAPCON called us again and said they were painting a UFO 4 to 5 miles over the coast, traveling in a westerly direction. They vectored us to the position of the UFO, and we, while on final approach, and we proceeded, but at that point we were low on fuel and were forced to return to Woodsmith Air Force Base. I remember that while on final approach, we saw the lights again near the weapons storage area. Following the mission, we discussed the incident, and about a week later, Captain Higginbotham was questioned by the OSI and cautioned not to discuss the incident. And that was, I mean, you have to say, a rather dramatic event with an object speeding away at the phenomenal 1,000 knots. Well, but it pales by comparison to the following by Jarrell W. White, retired U.S. Air Force, and was last known living in the Seattle area. The following is a direct quote from his account, and a fascinating account is it is indeed, and I quote, "My name is Jarrell W. White, retired U.S. Air Force, now living in the Seattle area. I don't know if you will get this response, but over the years it has become more clear than confusing about the nature of the Woodsmith UFO incident of October 1975. Reading about the incident in early years suggested I was not telling the truth until I now read that two UFOs were in the area and split up while being chased by a KC-135 tanker, one shot towards Saginaw, and the other found its way over to our Capehart Gate housing area and motor pool and munitions storage. Gerald W. White, Sergeant, stationed at the main gate, Woodsmith Air Force Base, approximately 10-20 hours, almost half hour of initially being posted there for the midnight shift. I never really noticed the extra activity over the radio because I was busy controlling the small rush of vehicles entering the installation, and which was normal for that time. I got a call on the hot phone from command post and answered it. The command post asked me if I saw anything over the Lake Huron. Just like that, and I looked and I saw a bright white light that looked similar to the planet Venus low in the sky. I reported that to the command post and they told me to keep an eye on it, and they could give me no more information when I asked what was up. I thought nothing of that and continued to my duty with oncoming traffic entering the base. Approximately 10 minutes later, the hot phone rang again. This time, I glanced up and noticed it was not the planet Venus, though, in the sky. It was larger and appeared to be coming toward landfall of the Michigan shoreline. I watched it for about a few more minutes as the traffic coming on base died down and I could pay more attention to it. And I noticed another security police vehicle approach my squadron commander, a major. I can't remember his name, but I can get it. The white light was approximately 5 miles away when the major and I watched it approach. I noticed some red lights and a slight swooshing sound as it closed in and stopped almost centered over the main gate, less than 100 feet to the right of the main gate, about 150 feet in the air. It was a piercing white light, so bright you could not see behind it, around it, over it. I felt it was low enough I could pick up a rock and hit it. At this time, no traffic entered the base, and I stepped off the platform of the entry control area, walked about 100 feet from the main gate directly under the blinding white light. It stayed there for more than 5 minutes. Whoosh, 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 in 3-second intervals was the only sound I heard. The major walked over, and we were both perplexed to what it was. We were both directly under it. This was for less than 5 minutes, and I walked back to the gate, and it began to move slowly, approximately 2 to 3 miles per hour, down the roadway, direct line toward the flight line, about 2 miles away from the Christmas tree alert B-52s and alert KC tankers, 135 tankers, illuminating the roadway as it went until approximately 3 blocks away the light went out, then lots of radio traffic. I don't know where Michael Myers was, but he did stop by and compared notes with me. The major departed after the lights went out to the command post. I was told not to speak of the incident, and I didn't, until I was going to retire at Grissom Air Force Base, Indiana, in 1990. I told a batch of new first-year troops of the encounter with the UFO when I was in my first 4 years of service. They said I was pulling their leg until one of them went to his room and came back with a Time Life book on UFOs, enlisted under Maelstrom Air Force Base UFO, was word for word the UFO account, except it only said Capehart housing and not main gate encounter. I've sort of kept my mouth shut until 2003 when I noticed the KC-135 was chasing two UFOs in a story starting from Loring Air Force Base and wound up at Maelstrom Air Force Base. I saw the second one. Now I feel better about the whole incident. End quote. Again, a totally amazing event. As is usually the case with UFO sightings, this was never resolved, never had the objects been identified. Interestingly, Wordsmith Air Force Base, it turns out, is only one piece of a disconcerting series of sightings. Over a period of about 3 weeks, in October and November of 1975, several Strategic Air Command bases in the northern tier of states were placed on high priority alert due to repeated incursions of unidentified aircraft flying at low altitude over atomic weapons storage areas. The Commander-in-Chief of the North American Air Defense Command, known as NORAD, sent a four-part message to NORAD units on November 11, 1975, summarizing those events. The following are excerpts from that memo. I must add, though, I edited these excerpts greatly because I didn't want to deviate too far away from the topic of this video, which was the Wordsmith Air Force Base sightings. But anyways, from the memos, I quote, "Since October 28, 1975, numerous reports of suspicious objects have been received at the NORAD CU. Reliable military personnel at Loring Air Force Base, Maine, Wordsmith Air Force Base, Michigan, Maelstrom Air Force Base, Mount Minot, Air Force Base, North Dakota, and Canadian Forces Station, Falcon Bridge, Ontario, Canada, have visually sighted suspicious objects." Further on, the report states, "A teletype message to the National Military Command Center in Washington, D.C. reported the aircraft definitely penetrated the Loring Air Force Base northern perimeter and was on one occasion within 300 yards of the munitions storage area perimeter. The craft began to circle in the vicinity of the nuclear weapons storage area at about 150 feet altitude. When it penetrated the nuclear weapons storage area at 300 feet altitude, it was reported to command. And at 8:45 p.m., Sergeant Grover K. Eagleston, was on duty in the control tower when a call came from the command post requesting a radar track on the mysterious craft. And for about 40 minutes, he observed the object on radar circling around and then abruptly vanished from the screen as if it had either landed or dropped below the minimum level of radar coverage. End quote. A Sergeant Stephen Eichner, a B-52 crew chief, and other crew members spotted an unidentified object, red and orange in color, over the flight line, and it said it looked to be in the shape of a stretched-out football, somewhat cigar-shaped. When the object stopped and hovered, Eichner and the other men jumped into a truck and drove toward the object, and as they turned onto the road that led to the weapons storage area, they encountered the object at about 300 feet ahead and hovering about 5 feet off the ground. Its length appeared to be equivalent to about 4 car lengths. Sergeant Eicher said that it looked like a desert scene. He said, and I quote, "You see waves of heat rising off the desert floor, and that's what I saw. There were these waves in front of me, or in front of the object, and all the colors were blending together. The object," he continued, "was solid, and we could not hear any noise coming from it." End quote. Reports from other bases were similar. At one Air Force base, where the UFO hovered near the nuclear storage, actual codes on the devices had been changed. There are no answers to the events of the fall of 1975, and they seem to be as much a mystery now as they were back then. If anybody does have answers about where these craft were from, it has not been made available. I love a good mystery, and this certainly qualifies. Knowing that it happened less than a mile from my backyard at Wordsmith, whilst I was safely in my bed, makes me feel just a little insecure even now. Well, please check the description for my sources, where you can find even more information on the sightings at the SAC bases in 1975. Thanks for watching, and have an awesome evening. Three strange men, an updated version of the Men in Black, perhaps. The other day, I uploaded here a video about an unidentified flying object, which I and a friend spotted 10:30 at night on June 3rd, 2015. If you look in the description, there is a link to that original video. Now, what I'm about to tell you may have no connection to the sighting at all, and then again, I may have encountered a sort of updated version of the infamous Men in Black. These guys, three of them, were not in black, but they were nothing less than creepy looking. The original sighting took place, as I said, about 10:30 p.m. on June 3rd, 2015. And my friend and I watched the UFO for about 20 minutes, and the object was still clearly visible when we went indoors. How long the object remained visible, I cannot say. I tried to get photographs and video of it, and my camera is not of the quality that it turned out. It just turned out black screen. Okay, anyways. The following day, I walked to Rite Aid drugstore about 5 city blocks from my house. It was, say, about 10 o'clock in the morning. And when I was just outside the drugstore, I saw three men who I believe were coming out of the store, but I can't say for sure because I become rather confused, which is in itself rather odd for me. The memory is rather fogged for some reason. The three men were tallish, probably around 6'2", all had casual clothes on that were very neat, not a wrinkle, very meticulous. There were three very clean white cars parked nearby that I associated with them, though I don't know why, and I didn't see them go anywhere near those cars. I felt an uneasiness or anxiety as I looked at them, and they looked at me. And they walked towards me. All three looked nearly the same, and all three had the same smile, a strange smile, though I cannot put my finger on why their smiles seemed to so unnatural to me. Then they were gone before I knew it. I didn't observe them get into a car, nor did I see them or see where they went, because that seemed strangely blocked out of my mind, which is really, as I said before, very odd for me. I have thought about it and cannot remember any further data about them. But I did see two of them again the same day, about 2 hours later. I felt strongly that the third man was close by, but I could not see him. I had biked to the Dollar General store again with my friend Jean, and I stayed outside with the bikes while she went inside. Next door is the sports bar, and two of the three men walked around the corner looking at me with that same peculiar smile, but not saying a word. The three looked as if they could be triplets. Again, in this episode, I feel that my mind is somewhat fogged on any significant details. They had walked toward and past me, but I cannot recall where they went. They were looking at me as they walked past and smiling that really strange, goofy smile. And it's like they were just there and then they were gone. All of it may just be coincidence, and I am fairly confident that there was no connection to our sightings the previous night. But I have to admit that these guys sort of reminded me of an updated version of the classic Men in Black. While I say it may not have had a connection, it may have had a connection too. Jean had no recollection of seeing the men at all, and as I said, these guys seemed very, very strange. I had never seen them around before, and I have a feeling that I likely will never see them again, unless they wish to contact me. So thanks for taking a listen. I would be extremely interested in hearing your thoughts and comments on this most peculiar sighting. Hey, have a great day. Bye. Hey, you're looking at a picture, a still picture right now, of where the Cass River and the Tittabawassee River come together in Saginaw, Michigan. In ancient times, it was a very, very busy area, and as such, there are a lot of artifacts to be found in that area. I went out early today with my friend Gil Alberg and looked for prehistoric artifacts as well as historic, and found some interesting pieces, which I'm going to show you here in a minute. I'm going to show you some actual video that I shot while we were out on this farm field where I was finding, where we were finding the pieces, and then I'm going to show you some still images of the artifacts that we actually found. There were some nice ones. I mean, not beautiful spear points or arrowheads, but some nonetheless really nice artifacts that were utility in use for the people that were at this particular site. It was hard to ascertain what was going on at that site because I saw absolutely no pottery remnants. Pottery would have given an indication that it was perhaps used as a village site. Not the case there. All I found were lithics or stone tools. So I'm going to show you some clips first of the site itself, and then I'm going to show you individual pictures of the artifacts and describe to you what it is.
I'm at a farm field in Saginaw. I'm not exactly certain where it's at. I can't really tell you. My friend Gil Alberg brought me out here. He's been finding a lot of pottery chips and broken tools out here, prehistoric. And just today, we already picked up a nutting stone or a sandwich stone, I guess you'd call it. I don't guess you'd call it. I know that's what you'd call it. And fragments of chert or flint. And I'll take actual pictures of those pieces when I am back at home, but This, as near as I can tell, this is pretty close to the confluence of the Tittabawassee and Cass River. Cass River has a pretty big history of Native Americans, and in fact I have some videos on here that I'll try to remember to put a link to in the descriptions. So I'll take more pictures as I continue along, but I just wanted to get some setting shots and show you where I'm at. It's kind of this election day, November 8th, overcast and misty, a perfect day to be out in the field looking for artifacts. This is a little side creek. There's a little bridge up there, an old one that was made some years ago. It's a really pretty spot, very nice place to come out and look for the artifacts. I would say where we're at was at one time probably a village site. Maybe there's really scant artifacts here. There's no pottery that I've seen. So, it's hard to say exactly what was going on here in prehistory. But most of the artifacts that I've seen today, that Gil has seen, come from around that power line.
I'm
right at that power line tower now. I just found a huge tooth, and I picked it up before I thought of turning the camera on. As I scour the ground here, there are all kinds of fragments of flint from, tool production. Again, I don't know exactly what was going on at this site, but I have found a number of interesting stone tools that right now are in my coat pocket, which is weighing down. Those and show them to you a little bit later. I suspect this has been picked over for a long time. I'm only finding fragments of flint or chert, but I found a number of large tools that the average collector would just walk past because they wouldn't recognize it. Most of them recognize arrowheads, spear points, and stuff of that nature, celts. But I've found some interesting pieces here that I'll show you when I get back. But again, I think the arrowheads and that kind of thing have been pretty much picked over. It's still possible to find one or two here, though. But big tools seem to be the
one. I seem to have lost Gil and Freddy in the woods.
I'm going back to his car to put what I found so far in there. Maybe I can find some other stuff. Coming up on this cool little footbridge here that I guess the county or city put up here. You can see it's pretty neat though. It's in disrepair, and you can really very easily probably get hurt on it. But it's cool how the sides flare out and all that. Kind of a neat place. And then, the little creek. I don't know if this ditch was man-made or if it was, part of the natural water system here. But it's really a lovely spot, Weeping Willow Tree there. Very neat. So on the left is Cass.
Yeah.
And then to the left.
Yeah, island, they used to camp on it, man.
You did?
No, they used to.
Oh.
When they had the park, Riverside Park over there.
Huh?
They also had the campsite just across the river from it.
Hope you enjoyed the videos of the site that I was at. The first artifact that I want to show you is a very nice nutting stone, which are sometimes found in pairs, and when they are, they're called sandwich stones. Now this specimen has a depression on both sides. You see, when acorns and nuts were placed on the surface of the nutting stone, another stone was used
to slam against it and break open the egg corner nuts or whatever. And it would have been a stone about the same size as the as its paired piece. This piece is well-rounded and shows use on all edges for grinding. Besides crushing open the nuts, the edges were used, as I said, for fine grinding, which usually ended up making the rock or the artifact pretty circular. This nutting stone is a tan-colored heavy stone, and it measures about 5 inches by 5 inches by 2 inches. A really nice, nice piece that was picked up by Gil when we first went in. The second piece is a fine grinding and abrading stone. While all the surfaces show signs of use, one side is ground flat from use. This is a very heavy, dark tan stone, which is quite granular, not unlike sandstone, but much harder than sandstone. It's not unlike the stone used in grinding wheels today. But the piece is very heavily used. You can see it on all surfaces. This abrading stone measures about 6 inches by 4 inches by 2 inches. And I found this one in close proximity to the nutting stone that Gil picked up. Now, one edge in particular is flattened from use. Really cool piece. It's unfortunate that when people have gone in to look for the display artifacts, the arrowheads and such, that they overlook these pieces because they're maybe not as attractive, but they were certainly as significant, if not more significant, in the life of the Native American who used them. This third artifact is also an abrader, but with a more specific purpose than the previous one. One side of this is humped and would be held in the palm of the hand. The other side is somewhat flattened with a deep groove worn into it. This was quite likely used for honing, perhaps, arrow shafts and other woodworking uses. It's a remarkable piece, really, and it measures about 5 inches by 3 inches by 2 inches. It is a rather greenish-colored stone. You can see small crystalline formations in it, and very easy to see that it was used quite heavily. Now, the fourth piece here is an artifact, and it's a very interesting one in that it is a handheld mortar for grinding perhaps small amounts of things. Now, this was finely ground concave surface, which shows very heavy usage. Now, this was obviously altered to be held in the right palm of the hand. Piece was knocked off there, so it fits right up against the base of the thumb. I don't know what you call that part of your hand. But anyways, if it's right there, it would have had, originally there would have been a pestle used with it. I didn't see any traces of the pestle. But this is an off-white stone, very hard stone, and really an excellent piece, an excellent display piece. It just bugs me when people go in and just look for the arrowheads and the spear points and that kind of stuff, because, yeah, they tell a significant part of the story, but every bit as significant are these artifacts, and you don't get a whole picture of any site if you don't look at the whole thing together. But anyways, I'll get off my bandwagon on that one. Now, this piece is a very primitive, but there are enough indicators to convince me that this stone was altered for use by ancient man. My dear friend who has since gone home to be with the Lord Jerry Wagner would say, I'm certain, 99.99% certain that it was altered by the hand of man. And I believe this piece was. But as I said, it's very primitive. This would have been a handheld chopping stone, which could have been used on wood or to break bone open, or many other purposes. One edge has been hacked or honed down, not really honed down, it's been hacked down to a crude cutting bit. The stone itself is very interesting, with a dark black greenish color, and very hard and very dense. And in this one also, you can see a crystalline formation. It almost has a patina, like the greenish like a like copper does, but it's not copper. No, when you smell it, you don't smell any trace of copper in it. And copper has a very distinctive smell. But at any rate, this artifact measures about 3 inches by 2 3/4 inches by 1.5 inch is thick. Now here we have a piece that I refer to as problematical. And I say that because, again, I believe that it's been altered by the hand of man for use. I can tell you what I think it is, but I cannot say it dogmatically. I believe this was a hefted piece, and that it displays some signs of being crudely grooved so that it would have been attached to a handle. Again, though, and used like a celt or an axe. But again, though, on this piece, it is just an educated guess. But being where it was found and in close proximity to other artifacts, I really feel that this was used by ancient man. This measures about 4 inches by 2.5 inches by 1 inch thick. Okay, here we have a piece that's not complete. It was a grinding stone. You can see the edge. It was rounded from grinding, much in the same manner that the nutting stone would have been rounded in grinding. This one has a really obvious crystalline structure. It is pinkish, whitish, blackish. There's a lot of stuff going on in it. I'm not good at telling different kinds of stones, but this piece was heavily used for grinding. And speaking of grinding and nutting stones, this piece is broken, as you can see. I believe that it was another nutting stone. You can see a depression on both sides of it. You can also see striations where it was used to grind, perhaps grind bone down to a point or something of that nature. This is a greenish material, very dense, very hard stone, and it was, again, a stone in that category of being a grinding stone. This tooth is very interesting to me. It's a large tooth. I believe that it could be oxen. The farmland was settled very early on in the history of Saginaw County. It was first occupied in 1835, and I can't remember the gentleman's name. But anyways, he did have oxen team that he brought in to work his land there. This is a large tooth, and I believe it is an oxen tooth, but I'm not sure. You can see a really interesting grinding surface on the tooth, and I almost went over this because there was just a little piece of it sticking out of a clump of mud, but thankfully, I had the presence of mind to pull it out of the mud because it's a really cool display piece and it's a really interesting piece, perhaps significant after the first Europeans came in here. Along with that, I found a small collection of white shards of pottery, not Indian pottery, European pottery. And these, it's hard to date material like this, but I believe that they would have been contemporary to the time period that the tooth was there and could very easily go back to that period of 1835. Now there are three pieces here, and I like to refer to these as thumb knives because they were held between the forefinger and the thumb with an edge, very sharpened, retouched edge for cutting. They were used extensively around the hearth or campfire for cooking and cutting the material that was being used. These are three really nice examples of thumb knives. Again, left behind by those who sought out the prettiest artifacts that may have been there. We know that Indians used stone drills to drill stone and bone. And here, what I'm showing you is the base of a stone drill. It is widened on both sides, thinned, and it, as I said, it's a broken piece. It's the base of one, and the drill point would have extended down from that base. It would have been attached to a shaft, much like an arrow shaft, and it was more than likely used with a bow-type drill, which did a pretty darn good job at making holes in stone and in bone. This piece is a broken piece. I believe it was being worked probably into an ovate knife form. It's not chert or flint, but you can see along the edge where it has been pressure flaked to form it into the tool that the creator was, you know, specifically going for. Even as it is, it would have been a very sharp knife on that edge to use also around the campfire or whatever. This next piece, it is chert. It has a dorsal ridge. I feel it was devitage from tool production, but I believe it was a waste piece that was used. I don't see any pressure flaking along the edges, but it wouldn't really need it because it was sharp enough just as it is. That piece is about 2 inches long and would have made an excellent cutting tool, an excellent knife. Okay. Now, this next little piece, this is really small. This is about an inch long, but you'll notice that it's notched. And that notch was used probably very much like a spoke shave would have been used. It would have undoubtedly been used in working on arrow shafts, and would have helped to shape that shaft of wood into a usable device, if you will. Here are two pieces that both display a notch. These were being formed into arrowheads. They broke as they were being worked on and thus discarded, but they would have been very small arrowheads, possibly even what is called bird points, which were used not just for birds, but were also used for small animals. Broken points like this are prolific on sites where stone was worked, because even though they were very excellent and proficient at working stone into tools, naturally there was some breakage, and these two represent breakage. This is a large piece of, I say comparatively large, of chert, and this too I believe was being formed into a point, but I'm not sure on that. But it's interesting because there were two kinds of chert that I picked up there. They were both bayport cherts, but one was nodular and one was tabular. This one was nodular, and you can see the concentric rings in it, and that means that it came from a chert nodule, which probably came from the thumb area of the state where bayport chert hails from. But it's a good example of nodular chert, which they used a lot of. But as I said, they also used a lot of tabular chert, and this piece I'm showing you now is tabular. Instead of the circle pattern in it, you'll see that it's straight. This came from a slab rather than a nodule. These next few pieces I'm showing you are all just odds and ends that were picked up. They were used for cutting. They are, you know, primitive cutting tools. Probably most interesting of those pieces is this one that you'll see, which is a piece of Petoskey stone, our state stone, state fossil. It's the only piece of Petoskey stone I saw there, and I don't believe it's native to this particular part of Michigan so much. And it very much looks along the one edge as if it had been was being worked down into a sharp edge, and it is sharp enough for cutting. So that little piece is also, I believe, altered by the hand of ancient man to serve as a cutting device. And then there were lots of fragments that were interesting, but they were just broken flakes and things off from the actual production of tools that, that were just discarded that didn't really have any particular use. Oh, I hope you've enjoyed looking at these. As I said, I enjoyed so much being able to go out and find them and to look at this site, even though, as I said early on, I'm paying for it with the pain that I'm experiencing today. But it was worth it. And please feel free to leave comments in the comment section below. I'd love to hear what you think. And hey, you have a great day, and God bless. The greatest mystery of my life, the 1966 Michigan UFO flap. You know, in my life, I've had many, many mysterious things happen. There was the Oscoda Image Stone, and the laughing ghost to the farmhouse up north, and the day the Indian elders made us invisible. Any of these, you can put keywords into the search engine here on YouTube and find my videos about them. But the number one spot goes to the 1966 Michigan UFO flap. And there are a couple of other videos here on my channel about the about those eerie events, but it's been 50 years this month, March, since the initial sightings, which well into the early summer months. It was in March that they were first observed. It is the greatest mystery of my life, and one that even now, 50 years later, there is no logical explanation. I remember Dr. J. Allen Hynek suggesting that these sightings could have been caused by swamp gas, and most people at the time thought that this was quite absurd. Why should this matter to me after 50 years? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but the big one is that I sighted it also, and that most mysterious image has haunted my mind ever since. It was strange, it was out of place. It was something I didn't understand and don't understand, so it has occupied a great deal of my thought over the years, over the past 5 decades. Back in 2006, on the 40th anniversary, I prepared my my own special postal commemorative sheets. I issued them under the authority of the Small Lake, Michigan Postal Authority, and I prepared 60 of them, affixed postage stamps, and took them to the post office in Bridgeport, Michigan, and had them hand-canceled and then began selling them on eBay. I kept 6 for myself. Why cancel it at Bridgeport when most of the reported sightings were downstate? Good question. Because Bridgeport was where I had my sighting, only about a block from that very post office. But let me back up a little bit and give you the background information on these sightings. Again, in March 1966. March, as I remember that year, was very unusual weather-wise. Temperatures were warmer than usual, and it seems that nearly every morning there was thick fog and little snowfall. There was a general feeling of uneasiness in the very atmosphere. And me? I was scared from the time I heard the first reports. I don't know why I seemed to have an unnatural fear of the objects that were being seen. The reports were everywhere, newspapers, radio, and even the news at the major television networks at their level. You younger viewers must try to understand what the world was like back then, because as they say, it was as different as night and day. Now we have become accustomed to instant access to world events on the internet. In 1966, we had snail-paced access to the news, but it was, you know, pretty great for us. We didn't know any better, so. The evening paper and television at 6 and 6:30 evenings and at 11 o'clock at night, these were our access to the news. Weekends, we didn't even have television news unless there was some major catastrophe The war in Vietnam was in full swing. The newscasts were always filled with the real horror of the stories about that war. At my dad and mom's house on Shreve Drive in Bridgeport, we received two TV channels fairly clear, and one that was iffy. There was WNEM, which was an NBC affiliate back then, but is now the CBS affiliate of the area, ABC TV out of Flint, and there was a UHF channel also, which was the CBS affiliate, but I don't recall their call letters. I do remember that that its studio had the reputation of having a hard, compacted dirt floor to run the big studio cameras on, and those studio cameras back then were monsters that were very, very heavy. Of course, we got the Saginaw News every single day, and that paints a little bit of an image of the world as it was in 1966. And as I said, this began in March that year, but they were not just, and these objects were seen by many, many witnesses, and not just ordinary citizens. Their stories were confirmed by well over 100 witnesses. One was a civil defense director named William Van Horn. Dozens of students watched the football-shaped object for hours as it maneuvered close by the University of Michigan campus, an airport, and a local swamp. The sightings of March 14th caused an uproar, and many people were in a panic, truly believing that Michigan was being invaded. And it might sound funny now, but when you, given the lack of access to news, the slower communication, it's not so hard to understand why people might have felt insular and isolated and invaded upon. Anyways, the feverish pitch of fear that I saw in the newscast put me into a horrible state that truly affected my life. 3 days later, on March 17th, two Washtenaw County Sheriff's deputies, Sergeant Neil Schneider and Deputy David Fitzpatrick, saw three or four red, white, and green circular objects near Milan, Michigan, about 4 o'clock a.m. March 20th saw more sightings by very reputable witnesses again. People were honestly afraid and began demanding answers of the Air Force as to what was flying around in our nighttime skies, because most of the sightings, well, not all of them, but most of them took place at night, making one wonder, are they aliens just hiding, or were they nocturnal, or are there aliens at all? My spirituality, my belief in Christ and the Bible indicates that there's not aliens, life forms out there. However, I saw what I saw, and it could be satanic deception, I don't know, but I saw what I saw, and it's still, how do we want to say it? It still mystifies me after all these years. I already read that for you, but the Detroit News carried the police chase story the next day, along with a now classic illustration of a craft that was football-shaped, had a quilted surface, had a dome, and antennae. Then Dexter patrolman Robert Honeywell said he spotted an object in the night sky around 9:30 to 9:45 p.m., and he reported that the object came close to the ground, hovered above a scout car, and was joined by a second object on its ascent. Now, I'll get back to my story shortly, but it's important to know the background of all that was going on. Washtenaw County Sheriff Douglas Harvey ordered all available deputies to the scene. Six patrol cars, two men in each, and three detectives surrounded the area. Officers actually gave chase to a flying object along Island Lake Road, but they never caught up to it. The Frank Manor family observed the lights from their farm on McGinnis Road. Mr. Manor was quoted as saying, "I got within 500 yards of that thing, and it looked pyramid-shaped to me. It had a light here and there and what looked like a porthole." And he continued, "It had a coral-like surface. I've trapped every hole in the county, and I've never seen anything like it." End quote. Manor had observed that it appeared to be about the length of a car and had a very hazy mist underneath of it as it hovered above the ground. Two other members of the Manor family, son and wife, also observed the object. Now, Frank Manor also described that it rose to the treetops and then fell back down to the ground repeatedly, I assume. And he also related that it changed colors, white on the ground, blue, and then red in the trees. And unlike other sightings, which were soundless, this one had a sound manner compared to that of a ricochet of a bullet, and like a siren at a real high frequency. Mrs. Manor put in a call to the state, to the police, and was shortly joined by Police Chief Robert R. Taylor and Patrolman N.G. Lee. And Lee explained, "I thought it was an ambulance," end quote. Also on hand was 16-year-old Robert Taylor, who also saw the red vehicle in the sky around 10:30 p.m. He said it was going on in the east very slow, and then it sped up and went west. It was flashing red and white the whole time, end quote. Washtenaw County Deputy Sheriff Buford Bushrow also observed it. His comment was this: "It looked like an arc. It was round. We turned around and started following it through Dexter for 5 miles. It was headed west. We lost it in the trees. Either the lights went out or it took off with a tremendous burst of speed," end quote. Frank Manor was asked if he could have been, if it could have been a college prank, and he replied they couldn't rig any rigging to the object, he reasoned. And then he added, "There was not anything there and no way in the world to get out there. There were two scout cars on the hill and more at the house." Manor continued, "I know every pothole in this county. I've never seen anything like it, end quote. On March 22nd, dozens of Dexter Hillsdale residents reported more UFOs, which were emitting strange sounds and lights. Then on March 23rd, a teenager from Monroe said that he took photos that looked like a big black blob when they were processed. The people of Michigan were truly, again, getting very scared, very edgy, almost panicky, and were demanding some sort of explanation from the government as to what it was that was going on, what they were seeing, what was flying about in our nighttime sky around the Great Lakes. Now, at that time, the Air Force was still conducting Project Blue Book. And they sent in astronomer and UFO expert Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And he had a thankless job that he had to do, because he had to come up with an explanation to satisfy the people of the state of Michigan. And Hynek was the guy. He was an astronomer and a UFO expert. And what a detailed investigation he did. It lasted a mere 2 hours and 45 minutes. Not much time to dedicate to this. And when Hynek held a press conference at the Detroit press club, I believe it was at, he jumped from the frying pan and into the fire. He suggested the sightings were nothing more than swamp gas. Hynek was quoted as saying, "The lights resemble tiny flames, sometimes seen right on the ground, and sometimes merely float above it. The flames go out in one place and suddenly appear in another place, giving the illusion of motion, the illusion of them being almost playful. The colors are sometimes yellow, sometimes red, and blue-green. Now, Hynek continued, "Marsh gas usually has no smell, but sounds like the popping explosion, similar to that of a gas burner when it's igniting. The gas forms from decomposing vegetation, and it seems likely that as the present spring thaws came, the gases methane, hydrogen sulfide, and phosphine resulting from decomposition of organic materials were released," end quote. In later years, Hynek became a believer in UFOs and expressed his opinion that UFOs are indeed real, and that he regretted his swamp gas analysis. Swamp gas was a crazy explanation, number one. Crazy explanation number two was his belief that youths were playing tricks with flares added to the panic. And of that photo taken by the teen back in March 17th, remember? He dismissed it as a time exposure of the moon and the planet Venus. No one's fears were quelled by the ridiculous explanations, and Van Horn, who had grew up on the edge of a swamp, was outraged by Hynek's findings. He was particularly resentful that Hynek indeed ignored his and other reports, which clearly showed that they could not possibly have been swamp gas. To be fair to the doctor, to Dr. Hynek, he was being paid by the Air Force to hurry along an explanation on short notice. Swamp gas was the best that he could come up with. Now, on March 29th, more sightings were again reported over Michigan, and they were seen in Macomb, Oakland, Bad Axe, Flint, Ann Arbor, and if you add my sighting, Saginaw County. And so these were all on the list. The sightings in 1966 continued well into the summer and is when my sighting took place. I don't recall the exact date, but I do remember that the night was very warm. The front door to our living room was open, with only a screen door being able to let a breeze in. My mother, Lorraine Cunningham Morrison, had her recliner right here by the door, and she could watch TV while looking outside at the same time. I also know that I was up fairly late for a school night, as Mom, Dad, and Sister Roseanne and Bill were all in the living room watching Peyton Place, so that would place it after 9:30. I was sitting on the floor by my mom's recliner chair, sipping a cup of tea that she had made for me. My dad was a coffee drinker, but the rest of us were tea drinkers. Anyways, I was watching the TV and happened to look out where a large self-illuminated green oval shape was silently floating across the night sky at maybe just 25 to 45 miles an hour. It was moving from southeast and headed northwest towards Saginaw. Once again, I lived in Bridgeport. I was terrified, absolutely terrified, and I was speechless, and I could not move a muscle. I was frozen right in place. I was so badly now, though, wish I could have said something to share that experience, someone who could speculate on what it was with me or who was controlling it. And here I am 50 years later, knowing nothing more than I did that night. And even if no explanation were possible by telling the rest of my family, it would have been a really amazing experience to share with them. I watched it for what seemed forever, though in reality it was less than 2 minutes, a minuscule time which has left me wondering so long what it truly was, my one great regret. I can say this for sure. What I observed that night 50 years ago was not like anything I'd ever seen, nor have seen since. Who or what controlled that object, I will probably never know. Only about 2 or 3 weeks later, my friend John Mertz asked me to stay overnight at his house. And that was on a Friday night. We did the typical things boys do or did back then. We read comic books, had battles with our G.I. Joes, and beat up each other while we were wrestling. Then we got to talking about UFOs. And John lived with his mom on Airport Road, also in Bridgeport, as far as 5 miles from my folks' house. And John told me that he and his mother, only a few weeks before, had seen a UFO just about the hover above the street light about a quarter mile away. It would have coincided with the night that I saw the object floating through the sky, and it quite likely was the same object. But I thought at the time he was just trying to make fun of what I had seen, but he wasn't. He called his mother into the room, and she confirmed what she and John had actually seen. Now, while Michigan seemed like an epicenter, there were dramatic sightings all over the country. Something very strange was going on in 1966, and I regret that I'll never be able to know what it was. Well, thanks for joining me. God bless. And before we go, I'm going to show you some clips from a program that aired, I believe it was on CBS TV in 1966, titled UFOs, Friends, Foes, or Fantasy.